I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and this is Women Who Travel. I'm so excited today to be sharing a story about food, memory, and storytelling from Cambodia. We'll be diving into making noodles roll by hand, the way our guest mother and sister used to make them.
This is how my mother rolled the noodles. And you can look at your watch and you see each noodle take about half minute. And it's a piece of dough, like a little finger. And when you roll it like this, you make the noodle tougher.
Chanta Ingun has written Slow Noodles, a Cambodian memoir of love, loss, and family recipes. She tells the story of her escape from Cambodia in 1970 as a nine-year-old, fleeing the dictatorship of Pol Pot and moving to Saigon and then a refugee camp in Thailand. After 2 decades of exile, she returns to a very different Cambodia.
You can ask me and I go out with you, and whatever you eat, I can explain to you what it is. We can go to the Khmer restaurant and eat Khmer food. Yeah, that's what we like from Cambodia. The world doesn't know about Cambodian food. And I don't know what is the reason. We are too small abroad, or we don't have anybody to help us to bring it out.
These are busy street markets, like the kind you would see all over Cambodia, all over Southeast Asia, with really crowded scooters and bicycles going through people cheek by jowl, and fresh ingredients and bounty everywhere, like fish jumping out of buckets and sometimes live chickens, and lots of vendors.
That's audio of Chanta recorded by reporter Kim Green, as Chanta takes her on trips to different markets all over Cambodia. And Chanta walks her through dishes that trigger her own memories. Kim Green is co-author of the book. She and Chanta are pretty much now like family. Right now, I'm talking to Chanta with her daughter Clara. They've travelled a long way to meet at Kim's home in Nashville before going on the book tour. First, Clara.
I flew in from London on Saturday, so I think it took me about 11 hours, so I'm slightly jet-lagged. My mom flew in from Cambodia, so quite a 13-hour difference, so I think she's having some jet lagged as well.
I know that London jet lag very well, but the Cambodia time difference I'm not familiar with. How have you been beating the jet lag so far?
We did have a bowl of rice porridge, or also known as congee, yesterday and today, and I think that helped cure a big part of it. So,
where did you find the congee?
We made it.
And I guess I now have my new cure for jet lag. Growing up, Clara spent many hours learning her mother's recipes.
A lot of the stories I heard growing up, and I think it was the same way that Kim heard the stories, are mostly through meals and times I spent in the kitchen with my mom. Her memories are often triggered by food, and it can be really difficult to guess which kind of story you're going to hear that day. It could be a wonderful story, a funny story about her time in the kitchen with her sister and her mom, or it could be a really, really sad story about her time in the forest or in the refugee camp or in Vietnam. And to be honest with you, I hated some of those moments because as a child, it can be really difficult to figure out a way to help your mother feel better. I didn't know how to help her feel better, and I hated seeing her cry. And I didn't quite understand how painful those memories can be.
Kim, what's it been like to hear all these stories from Chanta? And I guess sort of how did you go about honoring them?
Before you said the word honor just now, I was thinking the word honor because I felt like it was an honor to hear the stories and a big responsibility, because asking her to share the stories, it was a heavy ask. It was every time she told the most painful parts of her history, it hurt her. And so the responsibility that goes along with asking someone to do that is huge. But also it is an incredible honor to be trusted like that. I met Chanta in 2011. She was in Nashville meeting with a longtime donor who had supported her women's weaving center in Cambodia for years. So I did a story about that, and we hit it off. A year later, there I was in Cambodia and spent 2 weeks with her talking about whether we should write a book. And she wasn't sure whether anyone would care about her story, which shocked me because I certainly cared about it and I thought her story was really important. But I listened and we talked about her reluctance. And the biggest thing I think is that she didn't want to tell just a tragedy story. And so we talked about how to tell her story in a way that was threaded with hope and with her resilience, but also I realized during the course of that 2 weeks, I saw that whenever we were talking about her life and she was cooking or we were eating together, the stories just flowed out so naturally. And so I could see that cooking was her artistry. And she loved remembering her mother's recipes and the meals of her childhood.
We wrap the bánh chao piece by piece in lettuce and sliced cucumber and some mint or Thai basil and dip in sweet and sour sauce. But it's always fun together because we need many people to eat the bánh chao. Once you make it, you have to make it a lot. You cannot make one or two for yourself. So it's always the meaning of family togetherness for bánh chao still there.
I proposed this to her. What if we tell your story through those remembered meals and the recipes that your mother taught you? And in that way, your book could share your culture with people. And it could also pay tribute to your mother and sister and their artistry in the kitchen.
The more time you put in to prepare it, the better dish you produce. And for me, putting more time means putting more love. And the more care you put in, it shows that the time we spend together to prepare that food is will stay with you for the rest of your life. You remember the story, you remember the time you spend with your family, with my, especially me, and the slow noodles takes like many hours. And during those times, she told the stories of everything that just made me love the dish because of the story and the time we spent together. That's the memory brought back, the best time of my life. And that's how I tried to recreate it when I was able to, for my children and for my friends. That's the memory I had when I didn't have anything to cook and or I didn't have anybody to cook for me.
When we were talking about ideas for the cover with the designer, of course, the title is Slow Noodles, and there is an actual dish that is kind of the titular Slow Noodles dish. It's hand-rolled rice noodles. And you can actually see those in the design, the border. It's kind of these sort of irregular-shaped short noodles, ban khan noodles. People ask about Cambodian cooking or Khmer cooking, but not all Cambodian cooking is Khmer, especially if you come from a family that is of Vietnamese heritage or of Chinese heritage. So because Chanta's mother was Vietnamese, she cooked a lot of Vietnamese dishes. She also cooked a lot of French dishes, in fact. So Chanta's Cambodian food includes lots of different kinds of dishes, from French, Vietnamese, to Khmer.
Some of Chanta's fondest memories are sneaking out to buy street food snacks in Battambang, a town known for its culinary traditions, especially from one particular Chinese vendor.
That's the sound of his music, bamboo. And his wife sells fruit salad, what you call it. She put the fruit in the glass and then grated ice and then the syrup on the top. And that's my favorite place I spend money on any time of day or night. And with whatever the money I can get, like I asked from my mother, after every day I came from school, I asked her for 2 riel because that jackfruit in ice and syrup was my favorite. So every day after school, I asked my mother for 2 riel and run straight there. And a while later, when my father finished his work and he had his desk, so he emptied his pocket and he had shower. So while he was in shower, my mother was in the kitchen, I just borrowed 2 riel more from his pile and run straight to the jackfruit salad. And that's my favorite. Yeah, I never had enough.
I love that sort of thing when you're a kid because you think that you're totally getting away with it and that no one knows. And I'm sure both your parents knew you were going going for seconds. Yeah. Battambang is sort of a hub in the northwest of Cambodia. Could you explain a little bit about where it is? And Kim and Clara, I'm interested to know if you've gone there.
Yes, I can talk about that. I actually grew up in northeastern, bordering Laos. And I have been to Battambang a few times because it's actually the second biggest city in Cambodia. It's wonderful. The food is very, very good. And I remember the first time I went there with my mom. It was actually a very emotional trip because she talked a lot about her childhood, the church and the school she went to. And we ate a lot of really delicious food there. And my mom's amok, for example, is one of a very well-known dish from Battambang. And it's very different than any version of amok in the country. And it's a steamed fish marinated in curry paste, or we call it kreung paste, and with coconut milk. And you steam it in a banana bowl. It's probably the best version you can find in the country. It's from Battambang. Kim, maybe you can talk a little bit more about your trip to Battambang with my mom.
So here we are arriving at the grounds of the compound where Chanta's childhood church and the Catholic school she attended as a kid. The church compound was actually part of a functioning Catholic parish again. And it looked like it was really thriving, a beautiful, lush, serene compound. There's some kind of a funeral song playing in the distance, which is beautiful and ethereal.
This is the bell of the church when I was a kid.
It's a hot, beautiful, sunny day. Birds singing, and we find on one of the buildings a photograph of the old church, a group photo of some of the nuns and priests who had been there when Chanta was a little girl, and she remembered them, she recognized them. And then she spotted a man. He seemed to have an injury, a limp. He was there with a bicycle, and he was sitting there, and she walked up to him to ask him about the picture. And they're speaking in Khmer, but I see both of their faces lighting up, and they start to speak in this animated way. And after they talk, she comes back and she says, he was one of the orphans in the orphanage here when I was a student, and he remembers a lot of the same people. After so much loss and destruction, for her to have found evidence of her lost world in that moment, it just felt magical and it felt hopeful.
Coming up, trying to recreate dishes under conditions of extreme rationing became an act of resistance.
The run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support
that.
Yeah,
we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki?
Yes?
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tires, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners, subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. In the years she spent in exile in Vietnam, Chanta survived by cooking in a brothel, serving drinks in a nightclub, weaving silk, and making street food and producing tofu with her sister.
So we had a few years when my sister was selling tofu in the market, and that's how it came. But she, to make the good tofu, you had to bring it hot to the market, like the same with the rice noodle. She started at 12 midnight, and to be able to have the tofu sales in the market at 6 in the morning. So that's how we made the tofu.
The audiobook version of Slow Noodles is read by Clara.
So this is actually an excerpt from the book. It's during the time when my mom was in Vietnam. I quickly deduced that this new rationing math wasn't as simple as the slogan implied. The rules were in constant flux. Initially, we were to receive 9 kilos of rice per month. That sounded reasonable to us. But the next month, we were only allotted 3 kilos of rice. 3 kilos of potato equals 1 kilo of rice, we were told. And so we received 2 of our 3 kilos of rice in the form of 6 kilos of potatoes. The following month, the authorities declared triumphantly, "Now you will receive not merely rice and potato, but also cassava." As if by deducting rice and adding cassava, we had been granted a wealth of options instead of being deprived of the one thing we actually wanted. The month after that, it was announced that the potato ration would again decrease. Initially an exciting prospect, as we had consumed quite enough potato. But the party replaced the potato deficit with a stone hard whole wheat bread made from bad Soviet flour and fortified with small black insects.
When you ended up in Thailand, eventually, were there moments when food brought you joy?
No. In the refugee camp, it was even worse than Vietnam. There's no way food can bring me any joy, but the memory of food was useful by then. Thinking about the good food and to swallow the very bad taste food we had in the refugee camp.
What food did you think about?
And of course, I always refer to my first 9 years of life.
After the break, the return to Cambodia.
Join me, Esther Perel, every Monday in my office on Where Should We Begin? I'm talking to couples and individuals about love and work, about turning conflict into connection. More than ever, our relationships define the quality of our lives. So let's explore the myriad of relational challenges together. See you Monday.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Clara, I'd love you to do a second reading.
Here's when Chanta finally returns to a Cambodia she doesn't recognize.
When the bus stopped in a village, hollow-faced vendors surrounded us and stared into the windows. I bought Nom and Som, a sticky rice cake usually filled with pork and mung beans, and asked the seller, "Is there coconut in this?" She shook her head without smiling or speaking. This Nom and Som was nothing like the street food of my childhood. It not only lacked coconut, it lacked everything. There were no mung beans or meat in it at all. My first bite of Cambodian food since I was a little girl was just plain sticky rice with a few lonesome white beans wrapped in a palm leaf. It tasted like nothing I remembered. Slowly, I began to grasp the magnitude of what had changed. I saw no children riding to school or playing in the fields, just a few old people with faces of crumpled paper, solemnly selling meager fare by the road, and a high percentage of the remaining population seemed to be wearing a Vietnamese army uniform. I didn't know this place at all. I had kept nothing from my past, no photos or artifacts, only memory. Cambodia has changed so much in the last 20, 30 years. And I don't think my mother's story was the only story that I've heard about. I hear those stories a lot from my neighbors, from my teachers who lived through that time. Growing up in Stang Trang, in northeastern part of Cambodia, Stang Trang was not that much different when my mother had returned. There were mass graves everywhere, landmines that we were taught about in school to be careful. I remember learning it in first grade. On our textbook, there were pictures of signs of skull marks that we were supposed to look out for when we play outside. A friend around my age at the time who had stepped on a mine while they were playing or working. Cambodia has a very complicated past and history, and I'm so incredibly proud of the resilience of our people.
When people visit now in 2024, how should they seek to learn about this complex history and this complex past 50 years and be sensitive in doing so? Kim, I guess your understanding of Cambodia as well, a place that, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably didn't know that well before embarking on this project.
On my three trips to Cambodia, I'm seeing modern Cambodia, but also in my mind, I'm seeing Chanta's Cambodia, which is her pre-war memories, stories she heard from survivors of the Khmer Rouge era, and then her memories of it, the immediate post-war country that was so devastated. So I kind of see all those layers in my travels, but I think a traveler would just basically see the thriving modern Cambodia with, you know, the fun and lovely bar scene in the river promenade right there in bustling downtown Phnom Penh, you know, on a food tour in Battambang, Chanta's hometown. You're gonna see this thriving country that has remade itself after the wars. But under the surface, the past is always there. And if you look for it, you can find it. I think it's possible for travelers to go to Cambodia without really realizing what happened there, that their civilization almost was destroyed, that the cities were emptied. The whole country was turned into a huge forced labor camp. There's evidence of that everywhere, but you would have to be paying attention to know it was there. There's the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh, and I did go there. And the day I went, I had the strangest experience, and I can't explain it. It's irrational. But I remember being in there and watching a short documentary and thinking suddenly, I have to get out of here. I feel like I'm going to be locked in. I just suddenly felt bizarrely afraid for no reason. And I walked out the front door of that place, and I kept walking until I put several miles between myself and there. You can't see mass graves at the corner of the village, at the edge of the village. You would have to know they were there. You can't see that there's a former Khmer Rouge cadre living down the street and that people are afraid of him and they don't talk about him. But those things are everywhere, and you can only really know that by knowing people who tell you or by doing the reading. Even when I'm there, even when I'm in a normal situation in the capital and I'm in a bar and we're having a nice meal and music is playing, I still just think about what Cambodians endured. It's unimaginable, and it always fills me with awe and deep sadness. People are interested in her story, and not in a lurid, fascinated, tell me your pain, terrible way, but in a reverential, respectful way. Last night, we had a bookstore signing, and several young Cambodian Americans from Nashville came to the signing. And one young woman said, my mother's name is Chanta, and she is from Battambang. And now I feel like you've given her a voice. And she cried, and the two of them hugged each other.
Today, Chanta cooks often, just like the feast she's preparing right now in Nashville.
It's a food for poor people, but it's also a side dish that everyone enjoy it. But also the taste of my grandmother's pickles, it tastes different. And the description is, it's just good. It just, nowhere else can we can find the pickles like this.
Chanta has been working on this giant, giant bowl of spicy green papaya pickles, which are part of, we're doing a pop-up for a restaurant. One of our friends has this wonderful restaurant, and he is letting us run a Cambodian pop-up on Sunday. So we're going to be prepping for that. And I think we're going to have to sample a lot of the food as we prep. Mm-hmm. So amok is one of the dishes, the green papaya pickles. What else are we having?
Grilled pork rib, some stir-fry greens, which I think every single dish is from the book. And banana and coconut cream dessert.
Yeah. And we'll make up some kind of a cocktail with Cambodian-inspired flavors.
God, I want to eat all of it, and I'm fuming that I'm not in Nashville. That sounds fantastic.
We wish you were here.
Yeah.
I'm already dreaming of getting over to Cambodia to slurp some noodles and eat many versions of fish amok. This episode was brought to life by audio that Kim recorded in Cambodia. Next week in Women's History Month, we go to the skies and explore the conspiracies behind Amelia Earhart's celebrity and discover more about her peer, pilot Bessie Coleman, who also died tragically young. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.